Robinstown. So, you know, they share some features, such as dunes. This is called Home on the Range. There are times where no one else exists. They are more like places. I love the great American West, where the moon hunts us for a living. It draws closer and then away from me. Me, where I cannot be stopped. Under the moon's shadow stalk, where time encounters itself on the mesa and is rubbed sandpapery by its own imitable processes, I am, with an increasing frequency, becoming. I'm out thinking of wind in a low presence of wind, bending to stir the scrub and sage that attends the heart's climb from ridge to ridge. Of feelings, of course. The past must be a jerk. All those bonfires, dead dogs, a herd of horizons with me at its back. I nip and I nip. And yet, wherever I go, I find myself on my knees before a feeling so big it's already been annexed by the military. Being in love is like almost knowing what is about to happen before you are ripped apart by the sun and its belly. Like finally finding inside a haystack, there's a more beautiful haystack. From what did love all of a sudden rear up? Or the knife in my hand, where having one means I believe in my life, in the language of what it might become. This is a bit of a longer one, and it's got sections, and I'm just gonna pause in between so you'll know when the sections are. So I can't give you an asterisk in between. It's called the Lightning Field. In New Mexico, there's a field where people go
inside themselves waiting for lightning. To wait for the lightning in a field sown with metal poles. I have this only kind of visual idea. In it, I'm a pole that waits for a real feeling to pull in a downward motion towards me, like a tapestry or sword. I collect the times during a day I pretend to be in the act of knowing. In what I become while in the act of knowing, I am urgent, like a pole. All day, warnings have been ringing out the flat gray air, but I know what the weatherman is really saying, that I may be a monument to my own investigating whatever I want. The weather is a worthy adversary. It knows what it will all be like come morning. But it's here one way or the other, the lightning field in the desert mallow. But ever I am arriving at the present moment, bearing a great distance in mind. Even inside this sense of the great elemental, there's time to be a tourist. I can remember every time another person's asked me if I'm doing okay while I'm chugging a large container of diet soda in my element. And I can always be okay in a carnival kind of situation. There's even time to think of love, though perhaps this isn't. I can eat a corn dog. Who was it who said, no matter where you are, you can always smell the smell of the sea? When in a fish out of water type state, a person will sometimes say, no matter where she is, she can always smell the smell of the sea. Quote, it too burns the edges of the land, end quote. When there are no people for miles, my heart slows for the sand, which is granular and invisible, unless there's a lot of it in one place, like people. Before I arrived, there were two of me in the car. Here I am, eager to discover the sight of a future splitting the sky into its parts. To what do I owe the pleasure, I think, at the shadows explaining the shifting sky? It bears the mark of outside forces, the decisions of wind projected on sand, the tiny weatherman living in what I know whenever I know anything about the weather. There come with the body and the moment, of course, all kinds of limitations. Having only one of them, for example, and the issue of where they go when I'm not looking. Sometimes I call things other than what they are, but maybe in the morning I will once again escape blame. My involvement with the lightning field isn't straightforward. Like the evening, evenly spaced over the mesa, a combination of time and events delivered me. I'm looking to be planted evenly in the deep evening, then reached for by the warm sum of its facts. Could a plane of glass come to rest evenly on these facts? Their origins, concrete among the aster. Apricot mallow, purple aster, broom, anyway, there must be a light that cries out to be carried from one place to another by what can be seen is possible. When my mind bends again towards the sky, it's barely a skin on this earth, just a thought remaining of the old books altogether. When I can barely remember the desert, I can remember I lost the urge to see my own face, and that the lightning field did not find me buried like an egg under a warm, heavy sky and lift me up. Taking aim over the long-held breath of the plain, it didn't river down, transform the ground into golden soldiers. Light makes the desert look like the known desert. Illuminated on the plain in a series of events that refuses to conform to my sense of how long an observed event should last, the white dunes crest the view. Something known is locked inside my body. My favorite part about the tenderness part is that it is unnecessary. Often it's proper to think of an ending, then start there. This isn't the hard part. No one's saying what that is. A sky grown half wild as if with hair makes the mind red. I've gone desperate wild, or I don't mind the tenderness present in saying it. Like gawking from the car at too many cows in one pen makes me sad on the long drive away from the lightning field. Too many cows grazing openly will resist this little inference about suffering. The old heifers were never wrong either. Where reason, the color of hay may burst open near the road, the hay light spilling open. Any moment may be the one where I catch myself beside what I went into that field for and would again. Not today. There are so many different instances of time in one animal. Like an unvisited thought, a voice suddenly breaks through and tumbles towards the ground. It could be mine. Is this thing getting lower? It's like, get away. Okay, I have this one that's on the broadside that I'll read for you now. And then I've got one more. This is called If I Were to Rise Up All Colorless, which is a line from Dante's Vita Nuova. But that's not important. I just stole it. If I were to rise up all colorless, I could gather old thoughts the way a mind distant in love brings about a gathering of stars. I don't want people thinking I don't care about the future. Plenty of people are wrong about how I feel. For instance, I bought a bar of soap to remind me of a clean time coming, the smell of it. Even I wasn't right about how I was feeling then. Embattled by a sense of honor, I plotted to bring the smell of Lysol, like metal on teeth, straight into the future. Some thoughts, being in them feels like a battle to let a rare look inform me of how delicate and uncrackable I am. how like an egg, I can just roll myself under the heart in the exact right way, let it exert its pressure on my poles and never crush me. The stars, a gathering of paper under which we may be crushed. I was about to be proud. I felt a late wish of pride unfurling. When we arrive from distant cities cracked with love, I don't know if I'll want my new hands to work any differently than the hands I stashed in the drawer. And yet, by the smell of the gathering sky, I am arranged and disrupted. All right, so this last poem I've timed. It takes me 10 minutes to read it, so strap in. And I was talking to Rebecca, and I told her this, and she said I should tell you it, which is that when I first got here, I felt like I had the option of writing a bunch of poems and throwing away the ones I didn't like, which is what I usually do. And if I didn't like a beginning, to scrap it and make a new beginning. That was my one option. The other option was to start something and hate it and work on it and hate it and work on it and hate it and keep doing that until maybe, who knows? There's no guarantee that you'll ever like it. And I chose to do the second thing because I don't usually do it. And this seemed like an opportunity being here to try to do it in the window allotted. I'm admitting to you all now that I just developed my work ethic at Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center. And I did, and I didn't think that I was going to have anything with this piece to read to you, and a few weeks ago some parts of it clicked into place and I was excited by them and I started working on them, and now I have something to read. That isn't to say that it's done, but I don't hate it anymore. So that's nice, and I think maybe it's something we've all experienced at one point or another, and I'm a little late in the game, but I'm all my gratitude to the Fine Arts Work Center for creating the frame for that experience. So this is called White Sands, and when it's over, I'm done, and Stephanie is going to read to you, and boy, am I glad that she's reading tonight, because I can't wait. So you're in for a treat. But before that, this White Sands. Confidence. White Sands. If in pieces we are accurate, oh, it looks like this. It's just in little thing. There aren't complete sentences. So if I sound like a robot or otherwise disrupted, that's why. White Sands. If in pieces we are accurate is the initial question of composition. The we in question is made of a transparent constituency. Its parts cry out to be parts, together as parts. A vision of departing matters when the parts take it up together. Shifting over the tan plain, colors in a wide array. Beyond the, wow, sorry guys, what a diva. Shifting over the tan plain, colors in a wide array. Beyond the bank, white dunes, tan dunes, eggshell, wedding dress, frosted in the light, sun up or down. The shifting marked in slowness, or too speedy to be looked directly at. If I were to follow the sun directly, if I were to whirl like what's left behind in the water bucket, but I'm not alone here, knee-deep in a soft evidence of the particular. Totality is a triumph of the eye. The power I have is a power to be overcome by vastness. When weather surrounds the basin between the dunes, singular, a storm field you can sit down in with whatever bucket. A lightning rod passes for memory, time and the body making its way by the markers, The sand and the sky are double agents, have passports to blue and to an unknown transient clearness, their color describing the color of what's around. Stories don't compel me. There are countless other people dug up and transported to a site of a whiter, better beach, damaged by the digging up. Telling is gradual and impossible, like asking for forgiveness in the middle of the act. Betrayal has a solitary shape in the mouth, behaving like a bucket. The land carved by ice and time leaves nothing out, rotten with geometry. Even the sand and sky flatten their colors against each other, eager to belong to more than one horizon. One of the great surprises of a life is that you see a great many things before you die. It doesn't matter who you are. The charge to always be ascending, even as you hold the landscape in place, is a purpose from which you might be freed. Trees. The desert descends chromatic into a predictable swirl. Held up by the wind, the desert speaks of itself in the third person, where it is possible to love without water. Water helps. Am I best when buried up to my ankles in something, in pieces? Will I retain my features when setting up camp against the white sky? I could shuffle off into a bronze just deep enough to be tragic, a melted color on the edge of technology, a shift in the borders of a name to include more parts. The way a dune is its only reasonable form, each time it takes shape, my morning features emerge from the morning, off balance and precarious, a dune blown back. How long can a person in the sand get away without learning? Lamps are a challenge in wind. Just to live on top of the earth until you blow away seems simple enough and brave. A small desert town the wind blows through is like a small wind, like a streaker, swift and continuing all the way to the center of town. The city shudders my element out of itself, shrugs it off like a robe before stepping into the bath. I am the opposite of rising. Being in the car is a method, moving towards nighttime, where I can love almost by accident, without anybody else seeing. To find the movement of my own thoughts in the dark, first I must make it a home, dig my way through to depiction. If depiction is to drive headlong into what I'm seeing, we can only be described using words we've used before, unless we invent new words. That's where a name comes in, a made-up word, for nothing's ever happened quite like this when it has. Beetles, like tiny armored vehicles, define the sand, its defenses, the walk to camp. Time's ribbon rolling out ahead of me, where I won't know what kind of thing I am about to be doing. There's no such thing as about to be unfaithful, outside the bucket or in it, with two hands. The city is far away. The movement I am harboring inside my body is typical for a tree in the desert, typical the stars in their vividness. Apart from the clouds, there's never a right way to drift. As when driving past the prison I think criminals doesn't consider circumstance as granular. Another city on a long stretch of empty road appearing as an oasis built by deprivation. Technology makes a present connection possible. Though I've left love, I am still in my right mind. Action and inaction, both a making up of the mind. I make my bed like I make my behaviors, leaving others out of them. I lied when I thought I brought the city with me. Isn't that a kind of love? I'm still moving forward when I exit the vehicle, road blind, considering what's ahead. It's not a bad place to be, out of my own hands, in the dry season, or a love that knows no next move. Beyond repeating dunes, sections break apart, the horizon steady by all rights, night drags its compass by day. This feeling of not having made my life what it is, even in its fullness of missing, conceals my every move from me. I clear the debris, sand from the morning, and enter today's version with more right than I know what to do with. I am only ever myself, and that object I sometimes speak from, the heart I sometimes make believe I am without. My possession of details is rudimentary, like a flower's. Knowledge, the glass between myself and suffering. Without me, you wither. Without knowing more about me, you wither more slowly. The dunes pasted to the horizon, this portion of land concealing a made thing, like a kite hooking a cloud with its reddest corner. Love, after a fashion, particular, stays buried. How catchy a hand in a sleeve. The string around the wrist tugs, of course. Landscape enters, where love left the window loose. The song enters. I like it before I know what it is. I need what I don't know to love, leaving out. I love what I'm hearing as I'm driving. It's the only practice I have. The radio, green feelings. Everything that can be killed is delicate and is going to die. Lace on a windshield drives a fire in the ear, a change that's going to come. Who among these seeing sounds collides and can remain grateful? Morning is a string of unarticulated, warm, cold, wet, dry feelings. When even the flowers shake their heads, a fly reassuring on my arm bruises the air. The sunrise never needs to try to describe me. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to work on this mic stand a little bit, so talk amongst yourselves. Okay. Good time to get a drink of water. Actually, it started to slip down a little bit one time when the poet Josh Weiner was here, and he said that the microphone stand was D2-messing. Right? Just like we were living in a D.H. Lawrence novel. But I'll get it ready. Thank you. Oh, you need a drink real quick? Kelly, I can wait for you. You okay? Okay. All right. That was really wonderful. Thank you. Speaking of other microphone stories, I was listening to this reading once. It was a recording of John Cheever in the early 70s, and he was reading two stories. In the end, like, there was all this static in the microphone. The cord, there was something wrong with it, and they actually stopped and called someone in to solder the wire. And everyone sat there for 40 minutes, and they didn't turn off. So you could actually hear John Cheever, like, you know, complaining, and then soldering in the background. It was really, and I was like, it was in a university. I was like, they don't have another microphone. So I'm glad we didn't have to have Bob solder the wire. All right. Fiction fellow Stephanie Swallow was born and raised in Lake Charles, Louisiana. She holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and was a Truman Capote Fellow in the Wallace Stegner Fellowship Program at Stanford University. Her work has appeared in Glimmer Train, Ecotone, Tin House, and other journals and anthologies, and she received a literature fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts to continue work on her novel In Progress. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie Swallow.
Hi, guys. I know you.
That's not so scary up here.
I'm not going to drink out of Laura Eve's water, though. I'm going to open my own. I'm just going to second the many thanks that Laura Eve gave out and also reiterate how grateful I am to be here and to be here with all of you. I know I don't get to hang out as much as I would like, for obvious reasons, a very short, cute, obvious reason. But when I do hang out with you guys, it's always just so good. And when I don't, it's lovely to know that you're so nearby doing such beautiful work. So thank you for being here with me. And thank you to Matt and James for making all of this happen, and Bob for clearing our walkways. And Laura Eve, it's such an honor to read with you. Laura Eve is maybe one of the coolest ladies I know, and she's got so many talents, and I'm so blessed to live underneath her, where I can hear her beautiful singing and guitar playing as well. And she also makes beautiful benches, a bench. So many talents. And I'd also like to thank Jonah, my husband, who you guys know, sitting right there, who has made no small sacrifice to be here with me, and I appreciate it so much. Yeah. All right. So, this is a piece of my novel, In Progress. It's called Lafourche Parish, 1947. Lafourche Parish is one of the coastal parishes in Louisiana. It's an old Cajun enclave. It was one of the first places settled by Acadians when they were kicked out of Nova Scotia. So it's a very old, insular kind of community. The other thing that you need to know is that the main character is Jaco. He's an 18-year-old Cajun oyster fisherman. This is, again, in 1947. Already there were oil men everywhere, and the orange groves Jaco's mother remembered from her childhood in Leeville were long gone. In their place, an orchard of derricks. In the town of Golden Meadow, derricks rose from backyards. Nearly everybody had one, as numerous as the satellite dishes many years later, and the persistent hum of those beasts sucking blood from the earth annoyed people's ears but padded their wallets nicely. Not as nicely as you'd expect, but still. Oilmen in the boarding houses and general stores, on barges floating down the bayou, on rough long rafts, or behind mule and ox teams dragging pipe through the swamps. Almost all of them Texians. It took a few years before anyone would hire the Frenchmen, swamp rats with no English, didn't know nothing about nothing but tides and crabs. Then the Texians realized the swamp rats had spent their lives finding their way around this landscape and keeping their boats running with their hands, their own hands. Two of those Texians had come around to the ice house to buy something fresh for supper, a pair of men in brown linen pants and cardigan sweaters, the collars of their white shirts tucked under, and each with a fedora hat the color of an alligator's underbelly. One in glasses, one not. Both men of business, dressed for leisure. And there was Jaco in coveralls and mud boots, splattered to his thighs with muck, unshaven but without much yet to shave, a wide-brimmed straw hat topping his head and tied there in a knot beneath his chin. What was it that got them talking? The price of oysters, Jaco practicing the English he'd learned and his little bit of schooling between fur and fish seasons. In any case, they got to talking, and Jaco stumbled his way through the English, but didn't stumble nearly as much as he feared. He liked to talk, after all, when the talking meant something. He liked to put his charm, such as it was, to good use, to see whether he could make his audience reflect back the man he wanted to be. And sometimes he could, especially if he was dealing with people who didn't know him from Adam, and who didn't look at him through a haze of family history, who didn't see standing there in shrimp boots every boy in the Terrebonne clan who had ever worn shrimp boots, one more Terrebonne with webbed feet. These oil men who were nice enough, in that way that men are when they want something from someone they think doesn't know any better, saw a smart boy but not too smart, with enough English but not too much, and they offered Jaco a little money to come along with them into the swamps and act as their translator and goodwill ambassador. If it got him out of oyster fishing for even part of the winter, why wouldn't he say yes? The Texas men were working out of a motel room in La Rose, and about a week after they first talked at the ice house, Jaco hitched a ride with a cousin who happened to be going that way. He wore a clean and pressed pair of work pants that hadn't yet seen a day of work, and a long-sleeved collared shirt that he kept in his closet for weddings and funerals and going to dances with Rosalie. His good shirt, he called it, the best he could do anyway. He tucked it in, belted his pants. The motel room was brown and dark and billowing with cigarette smoke, and Jaco sat at the foot of one unmade bed while the men readied themselves for the day. He'd turned up too early on a fisherman's schedule, and one of the men answered the door in a towel, still wet. Jaco had never been in a motel room before and didn't know how to behave in such a small space with strangers. He braced himself at the foot of the bed like it might capsize. One of the men offered him a smoke, and he took it. The two men, once they were dressed, stood over papers spread on the room's only table, and they talked between themselves in a rapid, rattling English that Jaco couldn't follow. The one who wore glasses tipped his face downward and looked at Jaco over the rims, beckoning him. The Texian said, "You know what you're looking at?" It was some kind of map, hand-drawn and blocked in sort of a cockeyed grid, a body of water that seemed to be a river made a U across the left-hand third, and perforated lines ran perpendicular to it, the boundaries of parcels of land, no doubt. In a tidy uppercase within each parcel of land, names he recognized, Verret, Billiot, Dardar. The names told him what he was looking at, Indian Bend on Bayou Lacoche. He knew the bayou curled back on itself there, and he knew who lived where, who hunted where. But it never occurred to him how thin and spindly the parcels of land must be, with their little patch of riverfront and their long, long tails wagging out into the marsh. On another page, another map, another bend of river, more names he knew. The men explained what Jaco had already figured out. These were plat maps, official property surveys, for what looked like damn near the whole of the parish. They had the name of every family that laid claim to some little patch of ground, the entire parish exposed from above, naked to rapacious eyes, all those tucked away plots with their ramshackle camps that seemed sheltered, invisible when you were standing near them, sleeping in them. All these bayou people going about their days, thinking the world didn't notice them or care, thinking their best chance for going about their business was to do just what the Americans wanted them to, fade away into the swamps, stay out of sight, never even show themselves coming up for air. But someone knew they were there. Any someone with access to courthouse records knew they were there. "We want to go out here first," the older man said, and his fingers smudged the pencil lines of Indian Bend. "You know where that is?" "Well, I do. Best way is by boat." The men had organized a boat and a pilot, a cousin of Rosalie's. Everybody down here was somebody's cousin. Jaco and the cousin greeted each other in French, and for the long ride out to Indian Bend, The cousin tried to draw Jacko into chit-chat about fishing, about the men they were conveying, about the price they were being paid. But Jacko didn't want to hear himself speak French in front of these men, because he thought it maybe it was impolite, because he thought, what did he think? That he'd reveal himself, in spite of his best efforts at professional dress and American manners, to be the same sort of critter as their pilot. But he didn't even think it out that far. What he felt when the pilot cousin spoke to him in French was the turtling up reticence that afflicts any adolescent, the impulse to impress, or at least conceal the ignorance that might bubble up like gas seeping from a salt dome, a disturbance in the water that could, with the smallest spark, explode. To these oilmen from Texas, the little camp they found on the first parcel at Indian Bend must have looked practically abandoned, home to squatters maybe, no one's permanent residence. Its walls were rough clapboard, its roof a thick thatch. The steps to the front porch slanted acutely to the right, and the house might have leaned too, except that someone had braced the northern wall with two long poles sunk at a 30-degree angle into the soft earth. These poles seemed to be all that kept the place from collapsing onto the family within. But to eyes that knew what care looked like in such circumstances, it was easy to spot the signs of a home preserved as best it could be, as best as the means of its occupants would allow. There was wash on a line, muskrat pelts stacked neatly by size on pallets under a lean-to. There were clean-faced children in mended clothes tossing a cast net at the bayou's banks. The plump matriarch of the Billiot clan in a handmade bonnet made of flower sacking, a dress that was faded but pressed and clean, pushed open the door of the camp and scrutinized the approaching boat. The younger of the oil men said to the other, "Can you believe there are people in this country who live like that? Are we even looking at America anymore?" "Well, we are and we aren't," the older man said. The Billiot woman came down the steps, down to the water to meet them. "Comment ça va?" she said. "Ça va," they all replied. "Ça va." Even the Texiens had been around long enough to know that much French. Then the older man said to Jacko, "Ask her, can we come in and chat for a little bit? Ask her, is her husband on the premises? Tell her we have a business proposition that might benefit her and her family." The Texians and Jacko would sit at the table or on the porch steps, waiting for the man of the house to be fetched. Or they would promise to come back at a different time on a different day, if the man was too far for fetching. While they waited, if they waited, the thick-set wife or her thick-set oldest daughter would cook up a pot of coffee and put warm cups in their hands. They sipped from their cups and swished the grounds that settled like river sediment at the bottom. The Texians looked through their papers as though there were some point of business they needed to rehearse, and when they'd gotten sick of reading the same words, their eyes would start roaming the house. Some of the houses were clean and neat. Some were an untamed wilderness of cast-off clothes, tracked in mud, tools and traps in places where they shouldn't be, on the seats of chairs, atop the cupboard. It didn't matter whether a house was rich or poor. There were some run by women who kept things clean and some by women who didn't. Jacko could not just sit there, sip his coffee, invade these homes, but neither did he know what to say to the reticent grown women. So he got down on his knees and romanced the babies out from behind skirts and chairs, out from under tables. And if it wasn't the babies, it was the dogs, itchy, rangy beasts of no particular color or size, with no particular job except to follow the children from place to place or eat up whatever guts of hunted creatures the humans had no use for. No matter, dog or baby, Jacko could get them playing, so they were wound up and bouncing all over him by the time the man of the house came home. He didn't mean it to look one way or another. There wasn't a bit of a manipulative impulse in it. He just couldn't help himself. He knew what to do with babies and dogs. So when the man of the house would finally arrive, there would be Jacko tickling the babies, wrestling the dogs, and while they were talking, even then the babies would pester at his knees. All that certainly didn't hurt the Texian's cause. A man who seems to love your children wouldn't be part of any scheme to harm. It had a special word, a legal word, this thing they persuaded the Indians to sign. The Texians called it quick claim, though it was written quit claim on the papers, and Jacko translated it like he heard it, and he understood it like he translated it. So that's how he explained it in French to people who, like him, didn't know the first thing about property rights and leases and deeds. To him, it sounded like the quick claim had to do with how fast that $100 would pass into their hands, like it was the quickest way to claim that money. No red tape, as they say. Just sign right here and toot sweet like that, you got 2 years' wage. Then they'd drill for oil back there on your land. Not the land where you had your camp, but the land behind, up to the 40 arpent line and beyond. All that land you and your cousins mucked around in for fur and meat. And everybody knew by then what happened when the drill hit oil, the steady payoff, royalties. They knew that word, the promise it had. All of them, crown princes of their muddy domains. Words for a man's mark on paper. Nothing for nothing. The Texians left holding the same papers they came with, sealed in a leather case, and bearing the nearly identical X's of men who would not recognize their own written names. The Texians left nothing behind in return. It was a little paper to sign. It wasn't land. It wasn't oil. It wasn't a sack of shrimp or a box of pelts or new shoes and coats. An X in ink for a promise of cash money, paper money. Just sign your X here, and they'll come back in a week with an envelope of dollars. Well, what did it mean anyway? Those Billiots and Dardars and Verrets had gained nothing they could touch, but they'd lost nothing they could touch either. What was an X on a paper they couldn't read? At the end of his first day, the Texians gave Jaco $3 in paper money, and it was the first paper money he'd held in his life. An astonishing amount to be given merely for riding along in a boat. What had he given these men to come away with $3 for it? Some talking, some French, some chit-chat to remind the people in those camps that he wasn't any Texian. He was just like them. And look, he said, you can trust these men. Did he trust them himself? Did he know if they could be trusted? No, he didn't, and no, he didn't. But they were nice enough right then and there, and the money they gave him at the end of this day seemed more like a gift than a wage. His father, pretty much every man he knew, made around 60 cents on a good day if you averaged it out, and most of the time no money changed hands at all. For your sack of shrimp or oysters, you'd get something different than shrimp or oysters to feed your family. Sweet potatoes and onions at the company store, clothes, hardware for your boat. And at the end of the season, when the grocer would tally up what you brought in and what you owed, you were lucky to come out even. Money? His father had a little tin of coins hidden under a floorboard in his work shed, and he'd fish out some pittance when there was no other way to pay. But there was usually some other way to pay. Most days you traded something you could touch and use for something else you could touch and use. Nobody had any money. There was no money on the bayou in those days. Jaco wasn't even sure where to put these $3 in paper money, or the three he would get tomorrow and the day after that. All the way home, he held them in the palm of his right hand where he could feel them and know they were there. Paper was so easily lost, torn, blown away, so light you couldn't feel it in your pocket. When he changed out of his good clothes, the bills sat rumpled and conspicuous on his cot, a paler green on the green woolen blanket. All he could think to do was spend them. He took a clothespin from his mother's laundry basket, clipped the bills together in a roll, and stuffed them into his front pants pocket. He knew Rosalie's father would chide him for his absence on the boat, but there was always an extra pair of hands waiting for work. He'd done the man no harm but hurt feelings. By supper time, he was standing on the Broussard porch, telling the old man where he'd been. There was no point lying about it, more trouble keeping up a story in such a small place, where everyone was an unwitting spy and the most casual and innocuous conversation could be a lie's undoing. Old Mr. Broussard said, "How much you get for doing that?" When he dug the bundle of bills out of his pocket and held them out, Mr. Broussard said, "Well, nobody can fault you for going after that." Jaco could not tell if the old man was sad or ashamed or only tired from his day. Then Rosalie poked her face out the window and told him to wait just a minute while she put on something nicer. After they'd gone around to the Indians, the Frenchmen were next. Everybody was somebody's cousin, and that was just the truth, and there was no way for Jaco to look at those plat maps and not see the veins and arteries that bound each place to the others, a secret anatomy no surveyor would see. The property there was labeled with the name Cure-All, but it was bourgeois who hunted the back 30. This over here is where the court record said the Broussards had their homestead, but they also used the land all the way to the bayou, more than 200 acres that no one thought to pay taxes on, because until anyone began to think about what was under that muck, who cared who it belonged to? There might be a few folks who saw the need to mark their boundaries with stakes, but more often than not, there really was no need, because everybody knew who hunted where, that if you crossed bayou such and such, you were encroaching on the Broussard's domain. You might very well meet one of those Broussards, and depending on the Broussard, you might very well get a shotgun pointed in your face. Why bother with boundary stakes and fences that you just have to replace every time there was a big storm? If anyone bothered to lease the land just to anyone else, the lessee might very well be ignorant of the boundary lines altogether, or have only the vaguest idea that the Pete property ended somewhere on the other side of that chenier on the horizon. But how far over the chenier, even the owners couldn't say. It was like that for a long time, because really, this was land that nobody wanted. Why do you think they gave it away to all those Cajuns and Indians in the first place? One morning, when Jaco had been at this work for a while with the Texians, who, it turned out, weren't from Texas at all, but Ohio and Maryland, he said something to the effect that so-and-so wasn't paying property taxes on such-and-such a parcel, and he said it because it felt good to know something one step beyond what these men in their suits and sweaters knew. This little bit of intelligence he'd heard at the dance hall when someone had drunk too much. Jaco ran his mouth to these men, who knew just what to do with such stories. It was years before anyone was the wiser. By the time Jaco knew what was going on, the Texians had bought up half the land in that corner of the parish at tax sales. How did they let it slip? Did they let it slip on purpose to show the 18-year-old French boy he didn't know as much as he thought he knew? To show him his little bit of English couldn't buy him a place in their world? Not really. Young man, they might have said, boy, you've been more of a help to us than you even know. By then, the damage was done. And rather than admit he'd been duped like everyone else, Jaco shrugged his shoulders and said, well, that's your business, isn't it? Doesn't make me a bit of difference. It took a while for the people to learn what had happened, that they'd traded their birthright, such as it was, for a bowl of beans. No trespassing signs started turning up on the borders of property people thought was still theirs. And a few took those signs down every time, used the poles to brace their shacks, used the signboards to patch their walls. When they found a ditch cut across the marsh where there had been no ditch before, they thought, meh, I wonder who done that. I guess now I got me a ditch. If they had cattle, they put up bulkheads in that ditch to keep the salt water out and the fresh water in, so the cattle would have a new place to drink. Really, the ditch digger had done them a favor. It went on that way for years. Finally, when people looked around at the mess that had been made of their land, what they thought was their land, by the drilling and the cutting of canals, when they tried to get some of those damned oil companies to answer for it, what they got instead was another paper to sign. And this time, it was an honest-to-God lease. And if they could read the document, they saw they were being invited to place their X as lessees and not lessors. And if they intended to keep trapping on that particular piece of property, they'd better fork over X dollars to the very Texians they thought were supposed to be paying rent to them. As soon as one of them knew, they all knew, and though Jaco was years removed from the deception, and though he had only been first an ignorant and then an indifferent participant in it, those families who now had no land to their name did not forget the Terrebonne boy who had come around with the Texians offering reassurances and playing with their babies. And if they managed to turn up the records down at the courthouse, if some granddaughter, say, with a solid grasp of English, pulled up that quitclaim deed, they were reminded of the part the Terrebonne boy had played in this. There was his name, spelled out and signed in full, right next to their own wobbly X. By then, the Terrebonne boy had gotten married, had a young child of his own, had land of his own, had steady work in the oil fields, had prospects and friends. In other words, he was doing well, and they were doing poorly. And anyone might draw the conclusion that he had profited. And really he had, hadn't he, from their decline? Toot sweet like that. The money's gonna be yours. They remembered the words he'd left behind. Thank you.